Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231, October 15th, Wednesday. You had a test last time, so we're going to pick up lecture once again. And we're going to start with Introduction to Nervous System. Let's take a look at that schedule. Yes, last time, the 13th, we had a lecture exam, and the Monday group even had a practicum. And today, the morning and afternoon class has a practicum. And then after that last practicum, everybody will be halfway done with the class. Woohoo! It's amazing. How nice. Okay. So, we're going to get started with Chapter 12, and then next week we're going to cover central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. And our next test is not until November 17th. I guess maybe one of the reasons why is because there's a holiday in there. That seems like a long time away. It's what? It's 5 weeks away? And that's what I counted it out to be. 4.5 weeks, because that's going to be on a Monday. Okay, nobody has a practicum on that Monday. It will just be a lecture exam. But you will have a practicum before then, on November 3rd or 5th, depending on when your lab is. All right, and for the Wednesday group, please don't forget, I'll remind you again, that the very last day of class, which is a Wednesday, December 10th, exam 4 will be given. But since that's your last lab period, you'll also have a practicum on that day for the Wednesday. And that will be similar to what happened for the Monday group. This time around. Any question on the schedule, what you should be looking at? Again, people are asking what should they be doing for the tests and study guide. What pages you should read, end of chapter questions, online questions, exam figures, all that kind of stuff. Okay. If you have a question where those are, make sure that you see me. Okay, so any questions? No questions? Okay, let's get started then with the lecture, nervous system. I think you can probably organize nervous system because we've already looked at histology. And how many main tissues do you have in your body? How many main tissues, major kinds of tissues? Yeah, you got 4. What are the 4? I don't want you to forget about any of these. Epithelium? Okay, yeah, epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and now nervous tissue. Right, so this is the last tissue. Everything else that we're going to study in class is we've already covered the basic building blocks of. Right, so remember, epithelium lines the cavity, covers a surface. Connective tissue connects things together functionally or physically, like tendons and ligaments. Muscles, what is a muscle specialized to do?
Contract.
Yeah, and when it contracts, it pulls things together. And then nervous tissue, what the heck is nervous tissue important for? Communication. It sends information long distances very quickly in the body. So your brain, which is way up in your head, can't communicate with your toe very rapidly. So that's the nervous system. And maybe from tissues, remember there are 2 kinds of cells that make up nervous tissue. There are the kinds that send electrical signals. Those are neurons. And then the second kind will be the cells that support what neurons do. And so sometimes we call those support cells, sometimes we call them neuroglia cells, right? Okay. So I want to give you an overview of nervous system. All right, the basic divisions of the nervous system, let's look at in terms of function. So the slide on the right is a nice illustration, and you should fill this in as we're talking about it. So here I see a beaker with water in it, and it's emitting some light, so light is shining on it, bounces off of this beaker. And can a human being appreciate this beaker with water in it, with light bouncing off of it? Can a person appreciate that? Do you know it's there? Yeah. Why is that? Because you have a receptor for light, right? So this beaker right here with light coming off of it, that is a stimulus. So that is always the first part of this reflex loop that we're going to look at, or response loop. So stimulus is the first thing, and we can appreciate a stimulus if we have a receptor for it. We have to have a receptor. So if it is a light stimulus, we have to have a photoreceptor. if it is a sound stimulus, then we need a sound receptor, like our ears, right? And if it's a taste sensation, then we need a taste receptor on our tongue, in order, or smell receptor in our nose for odors. Okay, so stimulus will be picked up by receptor, and that's pretty cool, but that doesn't do us much good because that information should get to our brain for our appreciation. So here is a nerve that takes information from receptors and brings it into the brain. This is what your book calls sensory input, but you could call this a sensory neuron, or it has another name, and you should know what it is, and that is afferent. Here is an afferent neuron. Afferent is sensory. And which direction does an afferent neuron carry information? From the periphery into the central nervous system. That's how we would like to see that. And if we look at this arrow on the slide, is it a one-way arrow or a two-way arrow? It's just one way. So this particular neuron, the sensory or afferent neuron, only can take information or pass electrical information from one end to the other. Right? It can't go bidirectionally. It's only in one direction. And if it's into the central nervous system, then we call that an afferent or sensory neuron. All right, then the brain will then recognize that information, maybe compare it to what the set point really should be. Maybe if this is instead of an eye, if that's a temperature receptor someplace in your body, it brings in temperature information, and your brain knows what temperature you should be. And I tell you what, you probably know what temperature you should be consciously as well. What temperature is that? 98.6, right? Because we're homeothermic. So the brain knows what that temperature should be, and it compares that with the sensory, with the stimulus. And those neurons that do that are what we call integration or association neurons. And integration or association neurons are completely within the central nervous system. There's no piece that lies outside. All right. And then the integration center makes a decision on what to do. So, for instance, maybe the stimulus is a temperature below 98.6. Say it's cold. So what is the decision that this integration center going to make? What decision is it going to make? What should it do? Should you start sweating? If you're cold, you're shaking your head, no. That's right. What would you do? Maybe shiver, right? So that shivering information then is going to leave the central nervous system, okay, and it is going to go to an effector organ, and this is a somatic effector organ, namely skeletal muscle. So the nerve that connects the central nervous system with the skeletal muscle is what we call a motor neuron. And another name for motor neuron is efferent. All right, so afferent is sensory, efferent is motor, because an efferent neuron produces what? An effect. So here is an effector organ, and then the effector organ is going to do something. When it receives electrical impulses, what is this? That looks like a biceps brachii. What is this biceps brachii going to do? It's going to contract, right? So a muscle contracts. And that contraction symbolized by this dotted arrow right here is what we call a response. All right, so that's the label of all of these things that I want you to know. And I tell you what, let's go over it one more time. How does this thing always start? This is what we call a response loop. It always starts with a stimulus. And a stimulus then is appreciated or picked up by a receptor. A receptor sends that information into the brain or central nervous system via a afferent neuron or sensory neuron. Afferent and sensory are exactly the same thing. That information is then processed in the integration center with these kinds of neurons, which are called association or interneurons. And notice that they're completely within the central nervous system. The integration center then makes a decision on what to do. It might be nothing if your body temperature is perfect, but if you're a little hot or cold, it's going to make a different decision and send that decision to different parts of your body via this efferent neuron or motor neuron to an effector. And in this particular case, this is a muscle. So a muscle is an effector organ. And what does an effector always produce? It always produces a response. Yeah, so make sure you label this little dotted arrow response. So what does this response loop always start with? A stimulus, and what does it always end with? A response, right? So be familiar with it to that level. And know something about these, what we call these neurons. Sensory brings information into the central nervous system. So I see that the brain and even a little bit of the spinal cord right here is in a little square that has a background color to it. It kind of looks gray to me. Does this background color look gray? Okay, that gray color represents central nervous system. So you might want to put CNS right here. And then this lighter blue region, is this a little lighter blue, I think? Yeah, a little lighter blue right here. That represents a peripheral nervous system, someplace that is not in your brain and spinal cord. And then this looks like another beige area down over here. Again, that represents peripheral nervous system, something that is not brain or spinal cord. So maybe I would have made this top row and the bottom row the same color, except that they're a little bit different because one is sensory, one is motor. Now, if we look at these neurons, you see that the association neuron never leaves the central nervous system. But what about the afferent neuron? Where is it located? Partly in the peripheral nervous system and partly in the central nervous system. And what about the efferent or motor neuron? Where is it located? Partly in the central nervous system, partly in the peripheral nervous system. But this interneuron or association is 100% located in the central nervous system. That's something else that you can see on this slide. Okay, so let's look at a diagram right here that I made up for you. It's pretty similar to a diagram that's in your book, which I now put up on the right-hand side. It looks a little bit more complicated, but let's look at the left-hand side first. And so we see the nervous system divisions. The nervous system, if we look at all nerves in the body, we can break them down into two locations. And the two locations are central nervous system and peripheral nervous system, two main divisions of the nervous system. And when we say central nervous system, we mean brain and spinal cord. And they're located, what? Like centrally in your body. That's what we mean by central nervous system. The peripheral nervous system is everything that is outside the central nervous system. So all nervous tissue that is not in the brain and spinal cord is what we call the peripheral nervous system. All right, so just like the nervous system we can break down into two divisions, we can break the peripheral nervous system down into two divisions as well. And these two divisions will be sensory, right, and motor. What's another name for sensory? Afferent. Yeah, and now what's the function of an afferent neuron? What does it do? It receives information, and where does it send it? To the central nervous system. So it's bringing information into the brain, or maybe a spinal cord. That is an afferent division. And the motor division is the opposite. It takes information from the CNS, brain or spinal cord, out to the periphery, right? So that's what we call an efferent division. All right, well, just like we can break down the nervous system into two divisions and the peripheral nervous system down into two divisions, we can break the motor or efferent division down into two major divisions as well. All right, and I know you might not appreciate this all in one day, so every time you think of or study the nervous system, I want you to relate it to this flow diagram, okay, so that you can see what all the pieces are. All right, so motor or efferent, which way are signals going once again for efferent? Out from the central nervous system, right? Brain to the periphery. All right, so efferent can be broken down into somatic and autonomic. Sometimes they have different words that are associated with these terms. Somatic means also in a sense voluntary, which means you have voluntary control of these effectors. Right, and the thing that you have voluntary control of in your body is skeletal muscle. And as a matter of fact, that's the only thing you have voluntary control of in your whole body. Right, and somatic just means body, and it means another way of thinking about somatic, it just means everything that is not contained in deep body cavities, visceral cavities. Right, so somatic means like skeletal system, skeletal muscles, things like that, but not like stomach, liver, heart, reproductive organs, right? That's not really part of your somatic body. Autonomic then refers to everything else besides skeletal muscle. Autonomic, and sometimes we call that visceral because most of these effectors are located deep within body cavities, like the abdominal cavity, thoracic cavity, right? So those are what we consider visceral organs, and they're not skeletal muscle. We're going to talk about what they are in just a second. All right, guess what? We can break the autonomic nervous system down into two divisions. They are called sympathetic and parasympathetic. And you might be wondering, why are there two divisions for an autonomic system? Well, you realize something when we looked at the musculoskeletal system. In order to have precise control and balance of your skeleton, maybe like your index finger, and you get pulled over on Friday, and like I said, the person with the fancy blue uniform asks you to put your index finger on the tip of your nose, right? How is that possible? It's not possible just because you have a biceps. Why is it possible? Because you have a biceps working with what? A triceps. You have muscles that are antagonistic to each other. And because of that antagonism, remember, that's an excellent, that's a beautiful thing, because then you have precise control and balance of your fingertip, where it goes. So antagonism is very important. The sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system are antagonistic to each other, because they don't have pairs of muscles like we do have in our body, in our somatic body. You only have one heart. You only have one stomach. So we need two different nervous systems to work against each other so that they behave properly. What's a good example of an antagonistic system or antagonistic systems in your car that you have to have? You would never dream of driving your car without these two antagonistic systems. What are they? Your gas pedal and your brake. That's right. So same thing for your heart. Your heart has a gas pedal and it has a brake, and because of that, you have precise control, although it is without your conscious control. It's autonomic. All right, so the relationship generally between the sympathetic and parasympathetic is antagonistic. So if the sympathetic is excitatory, then the parasympathetic is inhibitory, because they're antagonistic to each other. You can't always say sympathetic is excitatory. Sometimes it is inhibitory, but if the sympathetic nervous system is inhibitory, what could you tell me about the parasympathetic at that particular organ? If sympathetic is inhibitory, then the parasympathetic is going to be excitatory, because they are antagonistic to each other. All right, so we said that the effector organs for the somatic nervous system is skeletal muscle. And that's it. But what are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? We can break everything down into three kinds of organs. And here we see it right here. Smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. I didn't mean to have glands in a little lowercase like that. Should be the same as the other two. All right, so you have three effector organs for the autonomic nervous system. Smooth cardiac muscles and glands. You don't have voluntary control of these things. Like if you start sweating because you're hot, can you turn your perspiration off by voluntary control? Can you stop sweating? You cannot, because it's under autonomic control, not voluntary control. All right, and that's controlled by the autonomic nervous system. All right, so everything that we look at in nervous system, I want you to be able to put it into this nice flow diagram. And the diagram in your book pretty much is the same thing, right? It says, well, the two divisions are central and peripheral nervous system. Peripheral we can break down into afferent and motor, motor into somatic and autonomic into sympathetic and parasympathetic. But it also layers in some various organs right there that we talked about, but I didn't have a picture on this diagram. Okay, so this is a really important page to appreciate. Maybe draw it out once or twice so that you see the organization. Okay, basic division, central, peripheral. Okay, let's talk about a tract and a nucleus. If we have a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system, that's part of a neuron, and if we have a group of those someplace in the central nervous system, we're going to call that a nucleus. A nucleus is a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system. And where would we find a nucleus? Give me an example of some pieces of the central nervous system. Where would you find these things? What makes up the central nervous system is what I'm asking. Brain and spinal cord. Yeah, so the brain and spinal cord have nuclei. Right? But if we move out of the central nervous system into the peripheral nervous system, if we have a group of nerve cell bodies there, we might want to call it a nucleus, but it's not in the central nervous system, so we change the name. We call it a ganglion, a ganglion. Right? A ganglion is a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. The same thing in the central nervous system is called a nucleus. Now we have a bunch of axons carrying information someplace, either in the peripheral system or in the central nervous system. If we have a group of axons taking information in the central nervous system, we call that a tract. So where do we find tracts? Where do we find tracts? What are the divisions of the central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord is where we find tracts. Okay? But if we have axons carrying information in the peripheral nervous system, we can't call it a tract because tracts are in the brain and spinal cord. We call it a nerve. And you might be a little bit familiar with a nerve. Okay, and it's a little bit different than a tract because it has blood vessels and connective tissue. There's a nerve that goes through your elbow. If you bang your elbow really bad, you feel like this electrical shock going through your arm. Right? That's a nerve that you're hitting, not a tract. All right, so where do you have nerves? Peripheral nervous system. Where do you have tracts? Central nervous system. That is just some nice terminology. Okay, so information processing. Yeah, the nervous system processes information. We kind of looked at that already on the previous slide. There is a sensory nerve that brings information into the central nervous system from a receptor, right? And how does a receptor get information? What do we call that thing that interacts with a receptor? It's a stimulus, that's right. Okay? And then that afferent neuron brings information into the central nervous system where there are association neurons for the process of what? Integration. Right? So integration takes place in the central nervous system, and then the central nervous system makes a decision on what to do. Yeah, and then it sends that decision out of the central nervous system back into the peripheral nervous system to an effector organ, right? And what's an effector organ for somatic motor? Somatic would be skeletal muscle, okay? And what are visceral motor responses? What are the autonomic effector organs? Not skeletal muscle, but cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. That's what you would want to fill in here. And each of these effectors is going to produce what? A response. Yeah, so this information processing scheme right here always starts with a stimulus and it ends in a response. All right, so I'm mentioning that a lot. I think your book doesn't do a really super good job mentioning that. Just remember, that response loop always starts with a stimulus, always ends with a response, and then fill in the pieces between those things. All right, nervous tissue. The body contains billions of non-dividing neurons or nerve cells, and so that is mostly true. Okay, it's not absolutely true, but the number of neurons that we had yesterday are basically the same that we have today. They don't increase. So we don't want to kill many of these neurons off because we don't have any that are going to replace those. Right, so they're really non-dividing. And they have a couple functions. They can conduct electrical impulses. And of course, since we can't replace them, they live an extremely long period of time, unlike an epithelium, for instance. They don't divide. And they also have a very high metabolic rate. They require a lot of energy to send these electrical impulses over long distances. So let's see if I can find a picture of a neuron. And here's a really good picture of a neuron in this gold color. So let's break a neuron down into some of its pieces. All right, so here I see the nucleus and a nucleolus. Of course, that contains the genetic information. It contains information on how to build this particular cell, what kind of shape it is, right? All the little shapes of pieces inside the cell. So if the nucleus determines what the shape of the cell is and all of the pieces, the shapes of all of the pieces that make up this cell, what else does the nucleus determine? It determines the function. That's right. So the shape always determines what the function of something is going to be. And then I see some NIFL bodies. This is rough endoplasmic reticulum. Can you remember what the function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is? Protein synthesis, because there's ribosomes, and even free ribosomes make up NIFL bodies or NIFL substance or chromatophilic substance. It goes by different names. Chromatophilic means that it just absorbs stain, so it's easy to see. Function there is for protein synthesis to maintain the shape and function of this cell. And so you can see it's highly metabolic because the cell is making a lot of proteins all the time. So these organelles in the nucleus is contained in the center of the cell, and sometimes we call this the body, the cell body, right? And since it's body, there's another term that we used for body a little bit earlier. The connotation is not exactly the same, but that was, what area do we find muscles and skeletal system in, skeletal muscles and skeleton in? The somatic region of your body. So soma and body mean the same thing. So the cell body or soma are exactly the same terms when you're talking about a nerve cell. So the soma contains the nucleus and all of these organelles. Now, I see some processes sticking up off of the cell body. I see some that are short and highly branched. These are what we call dendrites. And dendrites are the receiving end of this neuron. So if they're the receiving end, what do they need to receive a stimulus? They need a receptor. That's right. So receptors cover dendrites and cell body. They can receive signals. They can receive information. All right? And then that electrical signal is passed down into something that looks like a little funnel right here. That's called the axon hillock. And that electrical information funnels into this one really long process. And this process could go from your spinal cord all the way down to the tip of your toe. So it's really, really long. And if things had to diffuse over that long distance, it would take, I'll exaggerate, millions of years. We don't have millions of years to share signals, right? So that information is converted into an electrical signal that just zips down to the axon terminus. All right, so this one really long projection coming off the cell body at the axon hillock is called an axon, and that is the sending end of a neuron. So the receiving end is dendrites and cell body. The sending end is this axon. It has different kinds of proteins in the membrane. That's why it is the receiving end. The proteins in the membrane for dendrites and cell bodies, you told me what they were already. What are those things that receive signals? These proteins in the cell membrane, those are? Yeah, receptors, right? They're receptors. We don't have receptors on axons or this axon terminus. We have different kinds of proteins that maybe we'll talk about. Not so sure. Physiology we talk about a lot, right? But I see that that electrical signal in motion is what we call an impulse, a nerve impulse. And which way does it travel? Does it travel from the end of an axon into the soma, or does it travel from soma down to the end of the axon? From soma down to the end of the axon. And can it go backwards? Is it unidirectional or bidirectional? Unidirectional. Information only flows in that one direction. So probably what you should think of is information flows from dendrites into the cell body and then into the axon, then down to the axon terminus. It just flows in that direction and never the reverse. So that is a nice neuron. This neuron that we're looking at has a particular shape that we call a multipolar neuron. And a multipolar neuron has a couple different functions. It could function as a motor neuron or an association neuron. So if you want it to be really particular and draw in a neuron into this diagram here, it would be the shape that we're looking at right now. It would be a multipolar neuron here, multipolar neuron here. And what would this dot be? What would this dot be here? It would be the cell body with dendrites coming off. Now, the sensory neuron is a different shape, and we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. That's called a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar. All right, so the neuron is the gold thing, but I see other cells that are associated with the neuron, and they kind of have a more of a white or gray color, and it kind of looks like a string of pearls that is surrounding the axon. These are support cells. And in particular, these support cells we find in the peripheral nervous system, and they're called a Schwann cell. And a Schwann cell produces myelin. It's a lipid. It's a fatty material. And a fatty material doesn't conduct electricity. It's an insulator. So a Schwann cell wraps insulation around an axon so the electrical signal can't leak out of the axon. But it does something else that's really special. It speeds the rate of that impulse. So myelinated axons transmit information much more quickly, hundreds of times faster than a non-myelinated axon. So that's why most of our neurons in our body are myelinated. They have Schwann cells around them if they're in the peripheral nervous system, and there's a different kind of cell in the central nervous system that does the same thing. I'll show you what that looks like in just a little bit. The spaces between Schwann cells is pretty much the reason why a nerve impulse doesn't move continuously down the axon, but it skips from one of these junctions to the next, to the next, to the next. These are called nodes of Ranvier. So when an axon has nodes of Ranvier, the impulse travels by skipping from one node to the next, which is a lot faster. I can't remember if you have to know what that's called in this class or not, but it is called saltatory conduction. Well, I maybe have it in my notes. I'll let you know. Saltatory conduction when it skips. And is saltatory conduction fast or slow? This is the important concept. Saltatory conduction is fast. That's right. Okay. Okay, and then here are the axon terminals. These axon terminals secrete a signaling compound when the nerve impulse comes down. And that signaling compound then can act as a stimulus to neighboring neurons. And that's how information goes from one cell to the next in the central nervous system. That junction between cells is what we call a synapse, and we're going to look at a synapse in a lot of detail. So these Schwann cells are what we call support cells, right? And this multipolar cell that we see right here, that is a neuron. So does a Schwann cell produce an electrical impulse? No. Does not. Which cell here produces an electrical impulse? The neuron. Okay. All right. In lab, we're going to learn some of these other little details like neurolemma. Let me see if I have a neurolemma. No, I don't have a neurolemma here. Okay. Okay. So a neuron can receive a stimulus, right? And it can receive a stimulus on a dendrite, then it is converted into electrical signal, flows over the cell body, goes into an axon, and then that electrical signal can skip down an axon. We call that a nerve impulse. Here are the three classifications of neurons by structure. We have multipolar, bipolar, and unipolar. Sometimes this unipolar is called pseudo-unipolar, and that starts with a P. And your book places these different shapes in kind of a funny location in this new textbook. It's all the way in the back, table 12.2. It's in the back of the slides. All right, so I see three classes, right? I see three columns, one, two, three. The first one is what we talked about already. You have a cell body with a lot of dendrites coming off of it on one end. On the other end, we have one long projection that we call an axon. This is what we call a multipolar neuron. We just got done looking at it. And we said that this multipolar neuron is found for the motor neuron and also for association neurons. So where would we find a motor neuron? The cell body is in the central nervous system, and then the axon goes into the peripheral nervous system to have some effect to stimulate an effector organ in your body. All right, I see another slide down over here. I'm not sure I know what this means. Here is that multipolar neuron, and I see three different colors right here. Who can tell me what these three different colors are? What does it represent? So dendrites and cell body look like they're in a blue region. What does that mean? Ah, that's the receiving end. Sure. Okay, that makes sense. And then the axon is in, I don't know, what is that, a beige? It's what? Pink. You're kidding me. No, okay, pink. Okay, this pink region right here, what does that represent? Oh, that's the conducting region, or I call that the sending region. Okay, the sending region, that is the axon in a nice multipolar. And then there's a third region, which I didn't mention, but I think I'm okay with this. Okay, and I don't know, you can tell me what color it is, probably this one right here. And this represents the secretory region. This is where a neuron will secrete a signaling compound, which can be appreciated by a neighboring neuron if the neighboring neuron has what? To this signaling compound, this signaling molecule. It has to have a receptor for this particular molecule. And if it doesn't have a receptor for this molecule, then the neighboring neuron will be, in a sense, completely blind to it. It can't tell that it's there. All right. So I kind of like this scheme. Neuron is broken down into these three pieces, the receiving end, the conducting piece, and the sending piece, right? Or the secretory region. Conducting and secretory, I like those. The next neuron that we see, let's talk about, here is the cell body with the nucleus and this whole substance, and it has something that almost looks like two axons, and they're on opposite sides of the cell body. Since they're opposite sides, we call this a bipolar neuron. But one of these projections is a dendrite and the other is an axon. And the way we can tell is because the dendrite right here has receptors on it. All right, this thing over here, the axon, does not have receptors. So that's how we know what the difference is. The cell bodies are very similar. The function of a bipolar neuron is for special senses, like for vision and hearing and for taste. That's where we find these neurons. So we don't have many of these neurons in our body, just only in a couple special locations. Bipolar for special sensation. So if it's a sensation, is this a motor neuron or a sensory? A better way of asking that, is this an afferent neuron or an efferent? Tell me afferent or efferent. Because it's for special senses, sensory is afferent. So this is an afferent only. Right? And remember, this one over here was either association or efferent. All right, so here's an afferent neuron. The structure looks different. So the receiving end or receptive region is right here, this really long dendrite and cell body. The conducting region is just the axon, and then the secretory region are these axon terminals. We're going to talk about the secretory region in just a little bit. We got one other kind of neuron. Here is the cell body. There's one process coming off of it, right? It's very much unlike this bipolar and a lot different than this multipolar. Since there's only one projection coming out of a cell body, we call that unipolar. But notice it only travels a short distance and then it bifurcates into two long processes. And because of that, some people call this a pseudo-unipolar. It's unipolar, but it bifurcates into two divisions, so they call it pseudo-unipolar. Same term. I usually call it a pseudo-unipolar neuron. So the receptive region are these dendrites right on the tip, right here, and then the conducting region is all the way from here, all the way past the cell body. Cell body is not even included in it, so an electrical impulse will travel all the way down and in this direction, from dendrite to the axon terminus, right? And then that axon terminus, of course, is the secretory region. So it's a little difficult to tell whether this is a dendrite here or an axon. So we come up with a different terminology to talk about it. The cell body is right at the doorway between the peripheral nervous system and the central nervous system. It's like right in between the two. So part of this neuron is in the peripheral nervous system, part is in the central nervous system. And the part that's in the peripheral nervous system is from the cell body down toward the dendrites. So this is what we call the peripheral process, because where is it located? Not in the central nervous system, but the peripheral nervous system. And this right here is called the central process, because where is it located? In the central nervous system. So here's the cell, partly in the peripheral and partly in the central nervous system. And that's how we designate these different parts of the axon, peripheral process versus central process. Nonetheless, signals still only go from dendrites, okay, to the axon terminus, which is in the central nervous system. All right, so if signals go from peripheral to central nervous system, what is this a good example of? Is it afferent or efferent? That's an afferent neuron, right? So sensory or afferent are unipolar. Bipolar is sensory, but only for special senses, like for taste, smell, vision. And then a good example of a motor neuron is a multipolar neuron. All right, so be able to tell me what neuron it is by shape, but also what the function is. And I think I have that on the list. Multipolar, motor interneurons, bipolar, special senses, unipolar, sensory only. And make sure you understand what the functional classification is, if it's afferent or efferent. Okay, the second kind of cell, so these are all neurons, because why do we call all these things neurons? Because what do? They transmit electrical information long distances. There are other cells that make up the nervous system that don't do that, and we're going to call these things support cells. Sometimes we call them neuroglia or neural glial cells, the same thing. They don't conduct electrical impulses, but they help neurons do their job. So they act to support, maybe protect, nourish, or insulate neurons. We talked about one that insulates a neuron, in particular an axon. Anybody remember the name of that cell that acts like insulation? That was that Schwann cell, right? And it puts down a myelin sheath, a lipid sheath, which is insulation. And what's the purpose of those Schwann cells? What do they do? Why are they a good thing? They speed up the rate of impulse conduction from the cell body down to the axon terminus. Okay. Well, when we look at support cells, I want to look at them in terms of where they're located, either central nervous system or peripheral nervous system. So let's look at central nervous system first, and those we do really like to call neuroglia cells. And I see four different kinds: astrocytes, microglia, ependymal, and oligodendrocytes. Let's take a look and see what these cells look like, and I'll talk about their function a little bit at the same time. All right, so here I see a neuron, right, because it's that nice gold color. Maybe this is a nice multipolar neuron someplace. I can't see the whole thing. I don't know what's a dendrite and what's an axon. All right, but nonetheless, here's a neuron that's conducting electrical information. Then I see some blood vessels, probably in red. These are capillaries, and that's significant because a capillary is the only kind of blood vessel that allows for exchange. Things can get in and out of the blood only at a capillary. So here we have capillaries in the brain because we're talking about central nervous system. So things can leave capillaries and go into the brain, or what's in the brain can get into blood by going through a capillary. That might not be a really good thing because we eat a lot of things that are very toxic and would inhibit the function of this neuron. Okay, and so then what would happen to you if we were to depress the function of all these neurons in your central nervous system? You couldn't regulate body temperature. You couldn't breathe automatically. What else? You couldn't digest. All kinds of different things. Couldn't regulate blood pressure, temperature, any of that kind of stuff, right? And so it might really be fatal. So there is a special barrier that prevents things from moving from the blood into the brain, and it is produced by this astrocyte. So an astrocyte is a support cell. And you can see it has many processes coming off the cell body. Some of these processes surround this capillary, and it acts as a special barrier to things. Not everything that's in the blood can get into the brain because of this thing that we call the blood-brain barrier. Blood-brain barrier is due to astrocytes. Another function of an astrocyte. You see that one process is connected to a blood vessel, and another process from the same cell is connected to the neuron itself. So the astrocyte is not only forms a barrier, but it's also a special door-to-door delivery system. It can take compounds that this neuron needs from a blood vessel and deliver it directly to a cell body or a dendrite or an axon. And could anybody maybe give me an example of what a good compound would be? What compound does this neuron here need to stay alive, to make ATP? We didn't talk about metabolism much, but maybe you might have a sense. An important energy molecule in your body is glucose, for instance, right? So this astrocyte can take glucose in the blood and deliver it directly to this neuron right here. So that's pretty fancy that can happen. Okay, astrocytes can also secrete compounds that will direct the growth of this neuron, right? And even today, there are astrocytes in our brains that are causing neurons to rebuild or remodel themselves. So even though this neuron was here decades ago in your brain, it does change shape, right? It will make new connections between other neurons in your brain. And as we learn things, that's how we can explain the learning process, is when different neurons make new connections between themselves. And so these neurons grow different connections to many more neurons that are in the neighborhood, so the shape of a person's brain actually changes as you learn something. That's one way that we describe. So the number of neurons doesn't change, but the interaction between neurons change because they grow more dendrites, right, and more branching patterns and axons. And what helps regulate that are astrocytes. So astrocytes are important for nerve development. The other thing that this says is that the shape of your brain that you have at the beginning of this class is a whole lot different than the shape of your brain after this class is over, because you've learned a lot of information. And I'm just always shocked that so many students actually hand their brains over to me so that I can reshape them. Okay, but they are definitely being reshaped as we think about all of this stuff. But that's okay, because that's really what brain tissue likes to do, right? It likes to reshape itself. That's another way of saying that probably the most important function of your brain is that it likes to learn things. It likes new experiences and likes to experience things over and over and over again. But it doesn't know what's a good experience or a bad experience. That you have to make up your own mind for. Okay, so that's an astrocyte. Now, where do we find an astrocyte? Peripheral or central nervous system? Central nervous system, and it's an astrocyte because when somebody first started looking at it, it reminded them of maybe a star up in the sky with these, like, rays of light coming out of it. Astrocyte. Okay, so that's one right there. Here is another one. I can see two neurons on this particular slide and another kind of neuroglia cell, and it's not wrapping anything around these axons, right? This is what we call a microglia cell, and it's a part of your immune system. So it functions to fight disease. And actually, it can move around inside the brain, and it can maybe find a tumor, and if it recognizes that that tumor doesn't belong in your brain, it can kill it. And we've probably all had brain tumors, but they weren't really significant because our immune system found those cells and actually destroyed that tumor before it became a problem, right? And one of the cells responsible for that is this microglia cell. But when somebody has brain cancer, a big tumor, for some reason those cells have evaded detection of these microglia cells. We're not exactly sure how that happens, but that can also explain why some people go into spontaneous remission when they have brain cancer. Because all of a sudden these cells realize those brain cancer cells don't belong there, and then that person's own immune system takes care of that cancer, which is the way that it should be. All right, so it's for self-defense, immune system, microglia cell. And can you see that it's a lot different looking than an astrocyte? Kind of looks similar, but it doesn't have all those connections to capillaries. All right, here's another kind, the third kind of four that we're going to look at. There are cavities deep inside the brain that are filled with fluid. So your brain is kind of floating in a chamber, and there's even water deep inside the brain. And that's nice because when something's floating, there's buoyancy, it's not quite as heavy, so the brain itself doesn't squish itself because it's floating inside your head. And these cells right here, some of them help produce this fluid in this cavity. This fluid is found in the cerebrum, which is in your cranium, you know where your cranium is, that's your head, but also in your vertebral column. That's where your spine is. So this fluid we call cerebrospinal fluid because it's in your cerebrum or brain and your spinal cord. So hence, remember, you can combine two terms in anatomy as long as we do what to that? Put an O, right? So we call this cerebrospinal fluid, not cerebral. AL is cerebro, cerebrospinal fluid. And these cells will line cavities inside the brain, and we call these ependymal cells. And you can see they almost look like, what, an epithelium, and that's how they got their name. But they're really not epithelium, they are really nerve system cells. Sometimes they make cerebrospinal fluid, but they also protect the inside of the brain from fluid that's in these chambers. That's another function of these things. right? So it can adjust the concentration of various kinds of chemicals that are in cerebrospinal fluid, which is important for the function of nerves inside the brain. Oh, look, it says right here, cerebrospinal fluid filled cavities. Yeah, and those fluid filled cavities, some of them we call ventricles, and we're going to look at ventricles. We're going to have to learn about four different ventricles in the brain. Okay, the last kind of cell, of neuroglia cell, and again, this is central nervous system, is what we call an oligodendrocyte. So here I see a little piece of a neuron, another little piece of a neuron here and here. These are axons. And here is that oligodendrocyte, which is wrapping itself around an axon. And these little wrappings here contain that little lipid material that we call myelin. So this is a myelin sheath. And the function of an oligodendrocyte in the central nervous system is exactly the same as a Schwann cell in the peripheral nervous system. All right, so now you can tell me the function of this oligodendrocyte. What does it do? Yeah, it provides for what? The skipping of a nerve impulse down an axon, which speeds up the rate of conduction. So it speeds the rate of conduction in an axon inside the central nervous system. And so all of these healthy axons or nerves, or I'd say neurons have myelin around them. And every once in a while, for some reason, these oligodendrocytes degenerate or they're attacked by a person's immune system. Maybe, we're not sure, maybe microglia cells start to attack the myelin in these cells right here because it gets confused, doesn't recognize that it's a normal part of a person's brain. And these oligodendrocytes start to disintegrate and leave plaques around these axons, which then these axons can't transmit electrical signals very rapidly. They begin to transmit them very slowly or maybe not at all because of the plaques around these axons. And that condition is what we call multiple sclerosis. So sclerosis is just a plaque that's forming around these axons. Right, so a good question could be, what cell is responsible for producing multiple sclerosis? It is? Yeah, oligodendrocytes. Right, when they stop functioning, when they degenerate. Okay. Who's heard of multiple sclerosis? Anybody have heard of multiple sclerosis? Yeah, probably everybody. You probably know some famous people that have it. Right? And it used to be a really debilitating disease. Certainly it's not a good disease to have, but it can be controlled fairly efficiently these days. And normally when somebody has multiple sclerosis, they have periods of remission and followed by periods of active multiple sclerosis. And so the job of medication is to extend those periods of remission and minimize those periods where they have that active form of multiple sclerosis. So it can be controlled pretty easily, but it certainly does change your life. All right, so those are the four cells. Who can name the four cells of neuroglia, which means in the central nervous system? What are the names of the four cells? We have astrocytes. I like that. Microglia cells. And what else? What do I have on the slide right here? Oligodendrocyte. And what's the last one, the fourth one? Ependymal cell, right? Ependymal cell. So take a look at those. Make sure you know the function of what those are so that when you see the shape of these cells, you know what the function is. All right, so let's leave the central nervous system and go into the peripheral nervous system. And how do you want to think of peripheral nervous system once again? What's a good way to say what the peripheral nervous system is? It is everything outside the central nervous system, right? So everything outside the brain and spinal cord is probably the best way to think about it. Outside the brain and spinal cord, okay, here I see a nice neuron. You should be able to tell me by shape, what's the name of this neuron, by shape? What is this right here? This is it has a single process coming out. This is a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar. And just for fun, a review, what's the function of a unipolar? It is sensory. It is afferent, 100% of the time. Okay? So I can't tell if these are dendrites. They kind of look like dendrites because if it was an axon terminus, then they would have a little swelling at the tip, and I don't see that swelling. So this is in the periphery, and here is in the central nervous system. So if this is in the periphery, What part of the axon is this? This is the peripheral process, and this part of the axon is what we call the central process because it's in the central nervous system. And is question? Satellite? Central nervous system. Yeah, central process here, this is the part of the neuron that goes into the central nervous system. And if this is a dendrite, okay, then this is in the peripheral nervous system. I don't understand your question. Is the slide labeled differently? No, it's pretty good. So this is just one long axon, okay? And remember that axon is for conducting nerve impulses. This part is in the peripheral nervous system. This is in the central nervous system. And it might I haven't really showed you what these things look like just yet. Okay? So maybe I'll have to do that really soon. And here are cells, right, in the peripheral nervous system that speed up the rate of a nerve impulse. These are what we call Schwann cells. What's the counterpart in the central nervous system? Oligodendrocytes. They both have nodes of Ranvier, so that nerve impulse skips. All right. Around the cell body of a unipolar neuron, I see other support cells. And since they surround the cell body, that reminded somebody of like planets that surround the sun, right? Or maybe the moon that is moving around our planet. So these are what we call satellite cells, and the satellite cells then help the cell body of this unipolar neuron do its job. Okay, so this is Schwann and satellite in the peripheral nervous system. All right, let me look at this slide right here. All right, so we said that if we look at the whole nervous system, it can be broken down into two main regions. What are the two main regions? I see two colors on this slide. Okay, I see that looks like green to me and yellow. Right? No, what is this color? Is that pink again? No. Beige. Beige? Okay. Beige is not green, I take it. Okay, beige. Oh, somebody told me beige is a brown color of some kind. Okay. So, what is central nervous system? It is the brain, right, that we have in the cranium and the spinal cord. Where do we find spinal cord? What protects the spinal cord? It is the vertebral column protects the spinal cord. Okay, so here we see spinal cord, and so that makes the central nervous system. When pieces of neurons leave or enter, right, or let's just say they leave the central nervous system, they either leave the brain or the spinal cord, then they become part of the peripheral nervous system. So here I see a junction between the peripheral nervous system and the central nervous system. And let me zoom way into this area right here. All right, so here's that junction between central and peripheral nervous system. This is where those nerve cell bodies of sensory neurons or nerve cell bodies of the unipolar neurons are. So the peripheral process goes in this direction and the central process goes in this direction into the spinal cord. So that's why we call it a peripheral process versus a central process. Okay. Myelin sheets. Oh, yes, continuous conduction is slow, and the fast kind, what did we call fast kind? Saltatory. Saltatory is fast, and what modification to an axon allows it to conduct in a saltatory fashion? What does it have? It has a myelin sheath, right? And a myelin sheath can be produced by two different kinds of cells, depending on where that axon is. Who can tell me the two names of cells that make a myelin sheath? Schwann cell and oligodendrocyte. Yeah, Schwann in the peripheral nervous system and oligodendrocyte in the central nervous system. If it's non-myelinated, it's slow, and we call that continuous conduction. Okay, what is, let's just stop thinking about the nervous system for a second and think about a structural and functional unit. What's the structural and functional unit of life? That's a cell. That's right. If you know how a cell is put together and how it functions, then you have a pretty good idea of how all life functions, because if something is alive, it has to be a cell. Okay? We also looked at muscle so far. What's the structural and functional unit of skeletal muscle called?
Sarcomere.
Yes, sarcomere, right? So if you know all the pieces of a sarcomere, all the myofilaments and the cross bridges and the sarcoplasmic reticulum, you know pretty much about how all skeletal muscle works. All right, so here's another structural functional unit that I want you to become familiar with, that, and that is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. How do cells communicate with each other? And that thing is what we call a synapse. Okay, so a synapse is just a functional junction and site of communication between neurons, and so we have to know, of course, its structure to appreciate what its function is. So let me find a really good picture of a synapse. Okay, here it is here. What about over here? Same picture. Okay, let's look at this. First, let's look at a neuron. Who could tell me what kind of neuron this is in part A of this slide? Okay, figure 12.5A. This is a multipolar neuron. What's the function of this multipolar? Could be motor or association. Okay, and here are some Schwann cells. Oh, so if these are Schwann cells right here, is this an association neuron or a motor neuron? I don't know if you can appreciate that just yet, but that's a really good question. We said association is found where? Completely within the central nervous system, association. But where do we find these Schwann cells? Peripheral nervous system, so this has got to be a motor, not an association neuron, because this part is in the central nervous system and it leaves and it goes into the peripheral nervous system, and that's where you find these Schwann cells. So this would be a good example of a motor neuron. All right, and remember, dendrites and cell body are the receiving end because they have receptors. So here is an axon of another neuron coming down, and I can see that it's touching the dendrites of this second neuron. And these places where it touches is what we call a synapse. So this proximal cell, or the first cell, is what we call the presynaptic neuron because it's built in front of the synapse. And the second cell over here, the distal cell, that's what we call the postsynaptic neuron. And information always goes from presynaptic to postsynaptic cell. I might ask you why in just a little bit. All right, so here is pre because it's going to send information. Here is the postsynaptic cell because it's going to receive that information. And, of course, that the different parts of these cells, right, really correspond nicely to what we've learned so far. So let's zoom into this area right here. Let's look at the communication between the pre and postsynaptic cell. All right, so we zoom way in. So here is the axon of the presynaptic cell. Here is the swelling at the end of an axon. The axon terminus forms a little button. Sometimes we call this a terminal button or a bouton, or sometimes a bouton terminale. It's got all kinds of different names. But it's a little swelling at the tip of an axon. So a nerve impulse comes down, and when it comes down, it can change the physiology of this little button. So I see some things. What do we see in this little button? Who can tell me of an organelle I should know something about? What do we see? Somebody say one thing really loud. Vesicles. I see vesicles. And these vesicles are not empty. They contain something. They contain a compound, a signaling compound, that's going to be used to carry information across the synapse. So we call these synaptic vesicles, and that signaling compound is what we call a neurotransmitter. Because what's the name of the cell that makes it? It is a neuron. Right? And what is that neuron going to use that compound for? To transmit information to another cell. So neurotransmitter pretty much describes this compound inside of a vesicle. What other kind of organelle do you see? Mitochondria. What does that tell you? Requires a lot of energy. Right? And that's why, for instance, when oxygen is cut off to your brain, how many seconds of consciousness do you have? 2 seconds, maybe 3 seconds, right? Because all of these processes require a lot of ATP produced by these mitochondria. All right, so those are some of the main organelles we see. When a nerve impulse comes down, and what is the direction of that nerve impulse? Going to go in two directions or only one? Only one, right? From the nerve cell body down to the tip of an axon. When it comes down, right? It takes these vesicles, or it sends a signal so that these vesicles move over to this membrane of the presynaptic cell. So this is what we call the presynaptic membrane, because it's on the presynaptic cell. These vesicles fuse with that membrane, and when they fuse, these particles, which we call neurotransmitters, end up in the space between cells. So these cells really don't touch each other physically. There's a space between them that we call the synaptic cleft. All right, so now we have neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft, and it's going to move. It's going to move by diffusion. Can anybody remember how does a compound move by diffusion? That's a good way to think of it. It's by concentration from, like if I open a perfume bottle here, and it goes from high concentration to low concentration. So this neurotransmitter diffuses from an area that's close to the presynaptic cell because that's where it's high concentration, right? It's just being released. And then by diffusion, it moves over to the postsynaptic membrane on the postsynaptic cell. And when it does, this postsynaptic cell can sense these neurotransmitters. Why is that? Why is it the postsynaptic cell can appreciate the presence of neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft? Because it has to have a receptor. That's right. It's not drawn in on this slide, but you might want to draw something in, label it receptor. And there is a structural relationship between the signaling compound or neurotransmitter and the receptor, and that is that the shapes have to be complementary to each other. Right, so this neurotransmitter can bind to a receptor if it has the right shape. You could use a lock and key model or maybe a hand and glove model. Right, and if the shape of this neurotransmitter changes, it won't bind to the receptor, and then the signal won't move across the synapse. Okay, so the signal in the presynaptic neuron is an electrical signal to move across the synapse. It gets converted into a chemical signal. And when that chemical binds to a receptor, that initiates another electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell. So the way information is transmitted is electrical, chemical, electrical across the synapse. All right, so I do want you to know what the names of these membranes are, the names of these cells, why mitochondria are important, because these vesicles have to be moved around via these microtubules within the axon and axon terminus. And what is the name of that signaling molecule that moves across the synapse and binds to a receptor in the postsynaptic cell? Neurotransmitter, right. We have various kinds of neurotransmitters in our body, and I think right now would be a good time to talk about a name for one of these various kinds. Anybody have? Yeah, ACH, which stands for acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is a very important kind of neurotransmitter. There are others, and what are some others? Let's just throw some others out. Dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine. There are even some amino acids that are neurotransmitters. So there's lots of kinds, but probably the most prevalent one is acetylcholine. Okay. So next time when we come back, all right, I think we're done with that. We're going to start talking about maybe membrane potential, maybe some other definitions that we find in the nervous system. Okay, please sign the sign-in sheet.